Thank you for listening to Ivy Podcast, where we feature weekly leadership conversations with thought leaders and industry experts. Now, here is your host, John Karsibayev.
Hi, everyone. My name is Adriana Samaniego, and I'm an investor at Female Founders Fund.
Adriana, thanks so much for making time to join us on the Ivy Podcast today. You are based in Brooklyn?
That's right. It's a very sunny day here today, so it's nice.
Awesome. Well, that's great. I'm glad we were able to finally connect. I want to spend some time talking about your current role with the fund that you're leading and all of that great stuff. But before we do that, give us a thumbnail version of your career to date, the timeline of your accomplishments and all the great stuff you've done prior to this.
Of course. So I started my career right at Google and started in our sales department. That led me, to find the intersection of business and inclusion in 20% time, which ultimately led me to create Google's first ever supplier diversity program to ensure that the company was procuring from diverse-owned businesses, and kind of led me to then develop digital programs for diverse-owned businesses, and then ultimately pivoted to try entrepreneurship for a couple years under Alphabet's incubator called Area 120, where I built a B2B marketplace. And then I decided, I am first gen, always wanted to get a master's, went and got my MBA, and with the goal of breaking into venture. And so here I am at Founders Fund.
Oh, that's super exciting. Very diverse career. So when you made that decision to go, get the MBA with a focus on venture funding and kind of the investing mm-hmm. space, what was the decision-making process there? How did you arrive at that? What were some of the motivating factors that really prompted you to go towards that direction?
Yeah, so I've always really loved one business, two, finance. I majored in finance as an undergrad, ultimately ended up, trying bank and decided it wasn't a fit and went into tech. But I think from the very beginning, I've always been interested in business and operating businesses. I come from a family of small business owners. And so at 12, I was their account, really running the books. And so what I decided was, at Google, I had the opportunity to build programs targeted towards small business owners and then ultimately larger diverse owned businesses. And I came to this point where I was like, I love this work. There's a lot of, similarities in terms of my upbringing and my ultimate passion, which was around how can I enable business owners, in particular diverse business owners, with the right information, technology, capital. And I was missing the capital piece. So at Google, I did a lot. We worked with them in terms of buying their products and services, built programs. I built a curriculum for with Dartmouth, for example, a digital curriculum, a boot camp for diverse-owned businesses. And then that capital piece was missing. And so I decided that I wanted to get into venture with the focus, again, still kind of being at the core of what I've always been most passionate about, which was how can I enable diverse founders with capital, information, et cetera. And so I decided, during my MBA, I would learn, what venture is, and with the hopes of working at a fund that focused on funding underrepresented founders.
Well, that's super exciting. And I want to spend a little bit of time talking about the whole you know, the direction of kind of, I'm very passionate about the whole immigrant aspect, because just being an immigrant myself, not even first gen, I guess zero gen. so working in that capacity from the angel investment perspective, that's been my forte, transitioning from the founder operator for many years. So as you graduated and you're going into the venture capital industry, just in general, tell us a little bit about that experience, and in terms of where you at right now, where were some of the expectations met, I guess, what you were studying for, or what were some of the things that were totally, you were not prepared for. So we'd love to get some commentary around that.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, I would say not too many people go into an MBA, you know, to get into venture. There's so many ways you can get into venture. That was my route. And I think one takeaway, though, that I would believe a lot of people would absolutely agree with, is there's just no common, really common thread. There's like some schools, but there's no VC that you look at and you're like, everyone got here, you know, for the, on the same path. It's a little bit of the wild, wild west, especially when you're in an MBA. And I think a lot of the things that I took away from, in particular, like the classes that I took that were related towards VC, very valuable, but I could have also done it outside of that institution. And I think one of the other things, to your point, you could do it, for example, you could angel invest and learn that way. But last thing that I'll say in terms of like what I experienced, I think the curriculum was good, but the thing that I experienced was, I thought the MBA would make it easier, you know, to transition into venture, but to be honest, I don't think it made it any easier. And I didn't realize how much of a hustle it was going to be in terms of not necessarily understanding the ecosystem, but just getting access and understanding, you know, how it works. That was a little bit of a challenge that, you know, an MBA doesn't prepare you for. And, you know, I think you're better prepared just reading, you know, a lot of tweets and to understand, you know, what's going on and what's happening, because that's where VCs tend to live these days.
No, that resonates on so many levels, especially when, you know, during my time, many years as a startup founder and operator, you know, I've started and failed a lot of startups. Luckily, you know, was able to have one successful one. And then as I was transitioning into the angel investment side, where I just wanted to take that experience and pay, you know, pay forward and share that experience with a lot of other founders, you know, from that perspective, there's really nothing that I could find that would prepare me for that. So it was just really a lot of experimentation and learning from kind of just that trial and error. And when you've talked a little bit about access, and I've encountered that, how hard that is actually, you know, the difference between the deal flow and access to, you know, certain investment opportunities, which really kind of the reason why I started the Ivy podcast and all that is just building that personal brand from that perspective to be able to really create that, you know, at the end of the day, the value add investor, you know, component that the founders right. would actually want you to join their organization, their company. So talk to us a little bit about that in terms of the whole space of value add investor, because when you talk to different communities of founders and the investors on this side, those are different sentiments, those are different perspectives always. And I can see both sides. Curious to get your take on that.
Really great question. I would say I'd first start off to that last point, which was like, I would actually recommend early on, I think I would have wished somebody recommended this to me, which is spend more time with founders than with investors, because you'll learn a lot more in terms of what it takes to be a value add. Because I think in the beginning stages of an investor, it's relatively easy to figure out, you know, how to diligence a company and that skill set. But as you start to move up within venture, that is, you know, one of the key as I can't remember who coined it, but the three F's, you know, funding, finding, and then fixing. And like the fixing piece, that's probably not the right way to say it, but how are you seen in the industry and how are you a value add investor? And I think for me, when you say the access and deal flow, you know, you could see a hot deal, but that doesn't mean that you're going to get into it. And so why is that founder going to choose me? Why is that founder going to choose Female Founders Fund? And I think for us, our brand has been immensely helpful in the market. And it's not Female Founders Fund, the brand that we have with founders. And so we're known in the industry and within the founder ecosystem to be a very supportive fund, very supportive investors, meaning we're with you in the highs and lows. And we're also known that we're not the largest fund, but we're going to roll our sleeves up because we believe that our success is your success, their success is our success, because we're proving to the industry as well. And so when you think about, you know, what does it mean to be a value investor? For me, it's being supportive and understanding where that founder is and what they need, because everyone is at a different starting point and needs something different. And then your willingness to roll up your sleeves, whether it's to build a model, which I've done, whether it's to have conversations on branding, if they you know, maybe they don't have that expertise, and you're there. And then the last thing is you just understanding the fact that there are going to be ebbs and flows, and you know, the investors who are going to pick up your own, who are going to make time when things aren't, you know, on the up and up, I think is really important. And I like to think that our fund, Female Founders Fund, and myself, that's something that we bring to the table, because at the end of the day, it's like, capital aside, how else is this how else is this investor going to help? And I think the fact, you know, if you also can open up conversations to potential customers, I think that is really, really critical as well. So being able to open up your Rolodex to your portfolio.
No, those are very, very good perspectives for, you know, from the whole concept of angel or VC from the value add perspective. And to me, it also boils down to, you know, one of my mentors always talks about is, you know, be a friend to a founder and not a parent. Because at the end of the day, if you're trying to prescribe your agenda or something, that's probably not the right space. And if you're able to build that relationship or have that relationship with the founder when things are not going right, and, you know, go grab a drink and talk about all the challenges you're having in very transparent manner, I think that's also a huge value add perspective from that standpoint. And the other point I want to make on the value add perspective as investors, it's for me, when I was a founder and operator, and still is for a few companies that I'm running, it all boils down to the value that I am trying to derive from the investor, because I should not expect the investor to be, at the end of the day, extremely proactive and kind of to try and come deliver value. Because there's a ton of other companies that they on boards of and they're trying to lead. It's almost like me being proactive and driving that value out of them. So I just always try to kind of help shape that mentality or that thought process for a lot of the founders that I'm trying to work with. So that's very interesting.
That's a really good point. And I don't know for first time founders, you know, how to prepare them for that. Like, how do you best optimize that relationship? Because, you know, some people it comes really easy and they're like, you know, the way that we do things is we do monthly check-ins, you know, instead of this like board, especially early on, let's just have a check-in. And, you know, it could be a shared agenda. It could be us setting the agenda, but how to best utilize that relationship. I think the conversation should be held more.
Right. Absolutely. No, I love that framework from that standpoint. So as we talk a little bit about the relationship with the founders and looking at the early indicators of that, you know, the FMF, the founder market fit, so to say, looking at their backgrounds, for me, at the end of the day, it's I love to follow their digital breadcrumbs. So also looking at what some of the work or projects they have done, you know, at the, you know, even at college level or even prior to that, to really get an understanding where they come from, what type of personality they are. Are they, you know, did they build a club or did they join the club? You know, things like that. I realize it's a very loaded question, but what were some of your strategies, at least initially, to identify that potential founder market fit or someone that you would want to get involved with in a more detailed manner? What do you look for? What are some of the indicators that you pay attention to?
Yeah, I would say the first, and not even the first, one of the most important ones to me is demonstrate resilience. And so that could be in a lot of different ways. And that's one of the key things that I'm trying to figure out early on, especially for, you know, any stage investor where there is not a lot of data to make your decision. Sometimes we're investing at a pre-launch. And so for that reason, you know, how can you get a better understanding of the founder market fit? And that is, you know, resilience, their coachability, and, you know, is there a pattern that I could look for? And so we look for a track record that demonstrates that pattern of success, whether they've been able to make, you know, good judgment. Have they been able, as you were saying, have they built something? What happened when they built their last thing? And so I would say, you know, for the example that I could give of a recent deal where it was pre-launch, we just announced the funding. It's a company called Fave. Her name is Chakel. And, you know, again, we're going off of a vision, a deck, and her. And so when doing diligence on her in particular, I was trying to understand, okay, is she resilient? Is she coachable? What is her vision? And then there's all these market pieces, but on her in particular, I was trying to understand, okay, what is Jaquel's superpower, and has she demonstrated resilience? Does she have a unique kind of position to solve this problem? And so she had formerly, you know, worked at Google, and was the products that she managed as a PM had a billion users that she basically brought onto the platform, and she created, you know, the tools that creators used at YouTube. And so it was directly tied to the industry that she was building for. Now, it doesn't always have to be that way. It could be that she could have been building, you know, in a complete different sector, but if she can demonstrate a track record and that she was resilient, then that is what we're initially looking for. And then, of course, like, just, you know, trying to understand if they have genuinely, like, are they curious? How do they respond to feedback? Because we're the type of fund that it does matter to us. We would describe ourselves as a kind of low ego fund. And so in order for that, again, that relationship, that friendship, because you're in this journey for a long time, for it to be successful, we want to make sure that those founders are going to want to work on this together. And so I think resilience is, to answer that, is the biggest. Like, are they going to be able to weather the ups and downs? They've shown a track record of demonstrating that.
That's great. No, I love that framework when it comes to the very early indicators for the founders, because that grit and determination, at the end of the day, they're going to go through hell. Can you live through that for the next 4 years, for the next 5 years? And are you treating the problems as opportunities, or you actually, you know, let those problems get to you and basically kind of go into the defense mode? So that's a great, great way to look at this. The other analogy that I've heard recently, one of the VCs was talking about, is the whole concept of the cartographer versus the navigator. Were you the one who's actually following the map, or you the one who actually created the map for others to follow? So it's just something that kind of, I love hearing that, when especially talking to potential founders and things like that. And I realized that even through this process, through the due diligence on the founders and getting to know them, it's a lengthy process, and it's, you know, it could take, you know, take a very long time to do that. While, you know, there's certain opportunities, they need to move a lot faster. What are some of the strategies that really help you kind of get to know, I guess, the founder, or their, you know, at least pick up on some of those indicators, their grit, determination, their ability to scale and learn, be coachable, clarity of thought? The reason I ask that is because I know quite, you know, some venture funds, they're able to, they have the capacity to make a very small investment and see how the founders operate and utilize that from that perspective. From my standpoint, I don't have that capacity, but at least I try to make that maybe introduction for the founder and say, here's an intro. That person may be able to help you with X, Y, Z. And I try to observe how they operate based on that introduction. What's the follow through? What's the follow up? Things like that. Curious to get your take on any of the strategies that may actually help validate some of that.
Yeah, I think you see it, you know, right after the first meeting, and there's a little bit of a balance, founders as well. But, you know, an example would be on that follow-up. So when I send a list of, in this world, we're doing it virtually. So if I send an email with, here are all of our, you know, diligence follow-up questions, and we want to be as respectful of their time and take a lot of time just to whether it be like formatting, making it easier for them to these like key questions, can provide us a link to their diligence, to their data room. But the follow through on that is critical, you know, what down to how fast they're doing it, because it kind of shows us like, are they excited about working with us? Are we chasing them? And sometimes you may be chasing a deal, and that's fine, but the follow up there. And then other examples, you know, post investment would be, you know, execution. Not everyone, it seems easy, but not everyone can execute. And so understanding, founders understanding when they need help and willing to raise, like kind of just say like, hey, look, I'm having a difficult time finding hiring for X, Y, and Z, or I need a chief of staff, and acknowledging that you need that support, I think is really critical. And if you don't recognize it, when we recognize it, being like, okay, let me put some thought to that, that's a good idea. And then even simply like, if we provide, as you're saying, intros, recommendations, customer intros, the follow through on that, there's a spectrum. Some people are just, you know, ninjas about it, and they're just amazing. And there's some people who are like in the middle, and then there's others that you get a little worried, and it could be again that they're just overwhelmed, prioritization and things of that nature. But those are a few things that you see along the way. But it all goes back to what you were saying, like, all, are you a problem solver? Are you resilient? And are you coachable? Which I think is why we value those type of characteristics, because we need you to have that, those skill sets for us to be helpful during this phase when you're building.
Mm-hmm. Right. No, I love those recommendations from that standpoint, because at the end of the day, it's, you know, you, like you said, you're going to be attached at the hip almost for the next 10 years together. So it's really finding somebody that you're actually going to enjoy working with. So that's, you know, that's very interesting. Thanks for sharing that. When talking about the different trends or ideas that really excite you these days, what are some of the things that you are researching in your free time, or that you personally passionate about, that you believe to be the next big trend?
Yeah. So one of the areas that I've been just really bullish on and love reading up on is is menopause. And so kind of going through the fact that everyone knows the world is aging, and the fact that every woman, no matter race, will go through menopause at some point in their life. In over four, call it decades, nothing has changed in terms of treatment, and people have just been silently kind of with this. And so I did a research study just trying to to be scrappy, which is another thing, you know, founders should be. And I was like, let me create a quick survey, send it out to as many people that will respond to understand what women are feeling and what technologies are out there and what type of how founders are approaching this problem. So that has been a really interesting area. And it's a really large market. So on average, women in menopause are spending $20,000 a year trying to find some sort of relief, whether it be supplements, doctor's appointments, et cetera. And so that's one area. And then kind of aligned to it, the larger area of longevity, which, you know, that's boomer tech. That's also death tech, which I think is fascinating. And these are all, you could call them like my taboo, like their taboo kind of areas of interest. But I think it's fascinating and is going to shape the world. The fact that like all of us, you know, at some point will not be here. And how are we making it easier for our loved ones to manage that process? How are we how are we rethinking death in general? So there's a really great community of in female founders who are creating in that space. And so those have been two areas that have been really exciting just to read up on and kind of understand what people are solving for, their pain points, and how can technology drive solutions.
Wow, very interesting, especially the death tech. That seems very unique and very niche-y.
You can be turned into a diamond. You can be a tree. there's like services, but there's also, you know, the opportunity, virtual, you know, this pandemic also brought to light the fact that, you know, people who are losing their loved ones, it's really hard truth, but you couldn't be there in person. And so there was a need for virtual services that is very different, you know, than what you could do today on Zoom and things of that nature. And so how can you provide virtual funerals and such? So it's also a really hard solution to market, though, which is why we haven't made an investment in that, because it's like, how do you build your brand and marketing strategy for something that is so sensitive and difficult to talk about?
Right. Yeah, I can't even imagine kind of how do you get the word out about that particular solution, I guess. That's very interesting.
Yeah, no one wants to think about that, but yeah. At some point, all of us will have to.
Of course. Yeah, it's inevitable. And it's something that, you know, there's definitely a constant need for that, which is unfortunate, but I guess, regardless, an opportunity. One thing that I want to add to, as we talk about trends, and I primarily invest in SaaS B2B sector, because that's my background, that's my expertise. And I was researching lately, reading some industry stats, that B2B wholesale is a $16 trillion market, which has less than 8% of it online. It was mind-boggling.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and I was like, somebody needs to start building some solutions in this space, you know, but looking at the market size and what kind of the opportunity is. And it's just, you know, a free idea giveaway for anybody looking to build something. Adriana, from standpoint of kind of the, when we look at the average day of, you know, in VC, in venture capital space, you know, building the deal flow, making connections and evaluating starters and things like that, share with us what's an average day for you is looking like these days. What do you spend most of your time on, and what do you wish to spend more time on that you necessarily can't due to the nature of everything else that goes on?
That's great. Yeah, really great question. We actually assess this as a team, and we put like, here's 100% of your time, how are you spending it, just to get us thinking and where you'd like to spend it. But I would say I spend 50% of my time on the finding and funding. So, you know, speaking to new founders, building out connections to different investors, and then diligencing and ultimately making that deal happen. And then I would say the other 50% of my time is split on portfolio support. So monthly check-ins, deep dives with founders, hiring, which it takes up, as you probably know, a majority, a bulk of the time of our founders, especially early on. So really sitting down and putting those strategies together. And then I would say, you know, that 50%, if it where I would like it to be, because right now it's like a 30 on portfolio and then 20 on just like fund management, team ops and things of that nature. I think I would like to have 20% of my time where I tried to earmark it this year, which was focused on doing these deep dives. I think we're consuming information constantly, just the nature of our job, but really getting the time to develop an investment thesis and dig into some of these areas of interest that ends up getting put on the back burner, at least for myself this year. And so having, you know, call it 15 to 20% of my time to like formulate, you know, a unique point of view on a particular trend and write more. I haven't had quite as much time to do that.
Oh, that's very interesting. And the reason I also ask is we do something similar, me and my team, that we constantly try to hold each other, you know, honest from a standpoint of like, hey, what do you spend most of your time on? And it's when you do that self-reflection and share that with the teammates, I think it's a great exercise, puts a lot mm-hmm. of things into perspective. Like, I just wasted my time, you know, most of the day on this task. I personally, I'm not a fan of, you know, the task lists and those things. They never work for me. I just usually kind of, I try to set one thing and just, you know, call it one major accomplishment, whatever, and try to focus on that. If I get that done, you know, great for me. But everything else kind of, that's what usually can eat up your entire day. So that's very interesting, kind of what you're talking about. And then as my career and I was getting into angel investing heavily more and more and more, mm-hmm. I was also helping a lot of other, you know, my circles, my friends who were getting into this space, and a lot of conversations around it were. So John, tell me a little bit more about kind of the average day, like in angel investing, because it all comes across as just a lot of fun, meeting a lot of founders and just like just shooting the shit. But one thing that I didn't quite prepare myself for is the level of rejection, which I experienced that as a founder when I was doing the fundraising. It's, you know, 99%, you know, rejection and one maybe. And on the other mm-hmm. side of the spectrum, when you evaluate so many deals, it's, you know, most of the time you say either no, not yet, or something that's not a right fit for me. So how did you deal with that aspect as you were getting yourself more and more entrenched into the kind of in this space and kind of building the stamina from that perspective?
It's my least favorite part of the job, the writing, passing emails or having those phone calls, because we're doing that all day. Like right. if you think right. about like we're if you think about, you know, how many companies we're meeting a week, and for Female Founders Fund, for example, we'll make, call it 8 to 10 investments a year. And so if we're meeting thousands of companies, and then, you know, at least reviewing a pitch deck, and then if I have a call with you, we want to be thoughtful and respectful and give you you know, at least some information as to why we passed. And so I think in the beginning, I remember telling my teammates, I'm like, does this get easier? Like having to say no so much. And they're like, no. I'm like, I wish we could say yes. But for me, I think though, what helps me is I'm going to say often, you know, 99% of the time I'm saying no. And I think what I feel good about though, is when I'm speaking to founders and when I've had a meeting, if I've had a meeting with you, that follow-up that you'll receive from myself or our team is going to be, you know, a thoughtful follow-up as to these are the key reasons like that we couldn't get across and what we would like to see. I think oftentimes, you know, the industry leans on you're too early, too much. And I hear that from founders a lot. And so we tried to give you just a little more information. Like we weren't sure if this was the right approach. Like we, you know, we've been wrong a lot, but that's fine. And so I think that has helped me, you know, manage the no's.
Yeah, no, it doesn't get any easier ever. It doesn't matter what you try. But one thing that at least has been helping me with that aspect of kind of the darker side of the industry, so to say, is really trying to come up with a way that I can help that particular founder who is maybe not the right fit for me, or maybe not the right time, where I'm just, not interested, and being very honest. But ending that conversation from a standpoint, it's a no, or maybe not yet, but here's something that I can help you with, maybe an introduction, or maybe, let me help you with your deck, or something from that perspective. I just noticed that for me, it was just a little bit of an easier transition, in the sense that, oh, it's not just a total rejection. It's just, I
Yeah,
remember you.
absolutely.
Yep.
But if you think about how much time as well that it takes to drive intro, that was, I don't know, if all VCs looked at, the tag of whatever you call your intro email, like how many intro emails have you sent in this year? That takes a lot of time, whether it be for other companies that you passed on or, trying to be thoughtful around one of your portfolio companies who's raising that next round and introing them to other interested investors.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. So in the last piece that I want to cover with you is really focuses on you, your self-actualization, your sources for learning. What's your content diet is looking like? What do you consume on daily basis to head ahead of the curve and educate yourself with so much information being available out there? How do you stay selective with what you let your mind be exposed to?
Yeah, I think I'm still working on this in terms of fine-tuning it. And I think, as they say, you are what you eat, you are what you read. And VC, you have to be, you're just consuming so much information. I didn't realize how much information. I think I love it, which is why I wanted to be in the industry too, just learn, constantly learning and being curious. So I start my morning off. I'm an early bird, so I start off reading. I actually start doing my personal meditation and prayer, and then I go into my kind of professional reading, which consumes, I start with blogs. I use Pocket and Notion to save articles throughout the week that if I somebody sends me something and just to tag it so I could read it. And so in my mornings I'll usually start there. I have my go-to blogs and newsletters that I never archive just because I love reading them. And so whether it be, let's like call it the Axios or Term Sheet, like they're lighter and really easy, I stay on that. And then some of my very specific blogs that on an industry, for example. So whether it be a founder or another investor who maybe invests heavily in it, and so going deep dive into some blogs around menopause or longevity, health, like a lot of health, we consume a lot of healthcare, we invest in a lot of healthcare, excuse me. So I'll read that, and then I usually end with, which leads me to my last article. I'll go through Twitter for like, call it 15 minutes. I like rarely post, but I go there every single day in the morning, right after I read a few like articles and news, and see if there was anything interesting that anyone is talking about, and potentially I'll get like one unique insight or article that I'll save for the next day, or maybe like somewhere in the afternoon if I get time. But I probably the first hour of my morning is because we don't have our first meeting until 10. So the first hour of my morning is just reading, which is nice.
No, that's super cool. And we'll make some of these recommendations in the show notes for our listeners. And I can relate with you on the Twitter side as well. I'm so new to this. I've always dismissed it, but just lately joined it and built my little bubble there that I live in for maybe like 30 minutes out of the day. And it's pretty interesting how kind of the people that I follow, where it's some of their thoughts and how that shapes kind of the rest of the day. So that's very interesting. The last question I have have for you, which I love asking during the interviews when I interview somebody for the job with me, because every time I meet somebody, I can't help it. It's always in the back of my mind, that evaluation in terms of, is this someone I want to be, you know, would want to work with? Is this someone I want to work for? Things like that. So this just runs through my mind all the time. And the question that I love is, how do you think this conversation went?
I think this conversation went really well. I had some background noise with the New York, city behind me, but I really enjoyed talking to you. I think you have, you know, you have like the operator in you. And so, talking to a fellow operator, it's just fun to, as you said, like shoot the shit and kind of understand how other people are thinking through things. And that's also what makes this job fun, is just getting the opportunity to talk to people who have a different worldview. And so I really enjoyed talking to you, John.
Oh, likewise. And I really appreciate all the insights you shared with us. You're very generous with the information that you shared. I personally learned quite a bit. That's, you know, like you were saying, that's the fun part of my day when I get a chance to meet great folks like yourself and learn from that. You know, I love that. I love that. I do that a lot with all of my guests, that we do a follow-up episode in about a year where we revisit a conversation we had last year. And a lot of really fun stuff comes out of that. Like, oh my God, I can't believe I was talking about this. So
yeah, they're like, did you invest in menopause? And what would I say?
Yeah, how did that work out?
Longevity, exactly.
Research, yeah, for sure. So we're definitely going to stay in touch and, you know, we'll set something up in the year so we can revisit that. So I'm definitely looking forward to that. Really appreciate your time today.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to the Ivy Podcast. Be sure to subscribe to our RSS feed on ivypodcast.com and all major podcasting platforms like Spotify and iTunes. As always, if you enjoyed this podcast, please give us a rating on iTunes.